and welcome to Life Matters. Robbie Buck in the chair for Natasha Mitchell this morning. Great to be with you. Are you a crossword kind of person? Do you love the challenge of solving a word puzzle? Or are you simply interested in how language has transformed over the years? The crossword has just turned 100, and helping celebrate is compiler David Astle, or DA, as he's known to his readers. He'll be in to share the crossword's fascinating history with you with his new book, Clutopia. Also, if you were to put yourself in the eyes of a person with dementia, what would you see? You may well be surprised. A new centre in Victoria aims to do just that, while helping carers and sufferers of the condition in the process. Well, this last week has been a very tense one for many residents of New South Wales, as they've faced their worst fires in decades. Most of the threat has been to the Upper Blue Mountains. No doubt you've seen the footage of the locals there battling these giant fire fronts. And unfortunately, the cost has been many homes lost, although thankfully no lives in that part of New South Wales at least. It's in the Blue Mountains that my next two guests are neighbours. Rolly Clark and Katrina Schlunker live on St. George's Parade in Mount Victoria, a spot that took the full brunt of the flames a week ago today. Welcome to Life Matters, both of you.
Thank you.
Hi, Robbie.
And thanks for coming in and sharing your experiences after what has been, obviously, a very traumatic week for you and your community. Does it feel like it's only been a week, Katrina?
No, it feels like I think time is time was strange right from the beginning, and so I don't know. I think about maybe a year.
Rolly, take us to St. George's Parade, the street that you live on. Give us an idea, a picture of what it was like this time last week, as opposed to 24 hours later.
Well, this time last week, 9 o'clock in the morning, it was there were threats of a pretty bad fire day coming up, and quite a few of us in the street were making preparations, getting the house ready, that sort of thing.
What sort of preparations were you going through?
We were, tidying up those things that you think you should have been tidying up 3 months ago, but not quite got round to, of course, and starting a fire pump, running out hoses, checking that it's all working. Generally, just preparing for, something that could be quite big.
Mm. What sort of street is it?
Well, it's a street that runs north-south on a ridge, and it's sort of one of three ridges, Mount York Ridge, and then the ridge that St. George's Parade is on, and then the ridge that Darling Causeway is on, which is the road that joins Mount Victoria to Bell. Mm. And there's just one street along the top of the ridge, and there's about 12 or 15 houses in that street. So they're quite sparse. And most of the people in the street were fairly well prepared, and they'd had experience with the CFU, which is the community fire unit. Mm. It's a trailer with all firefighting gear in it. And those people were obviously on alert.
Katrina, what was the morning like for you?
Well, I had been sitting and doing some work in the Blackheath Library, very quiet, and then got a call from the Simon, who's our fill-in captain for the community fire unit, and then I went and picked up my partner from Blackheath School, Susan, and we went towards our house, and then we were going, okay, next time we're going to move to Northern England. That was as a joke. and we arrived and we went and put on our uniforms and were doing some basic stuff in the house, because at that stage it wasn't we'd thought that the fire that was over at Mount York had been fairly well contained. And so we actually had this period of time where we're waiting, with the other members of the community fire unit, leaning against the unit, sort of watching and waiting to be activated and thinking, that this is actually going to be okay.
What kind of house is yours?
It's Hebel Brick, beautifully built by Rolly here next to me.
So hang on a sec. Rolly built your house first and then moved up the street, did he?
That's right.
Okay, and built another house.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the significance of that in just a moment. So continue on. You were there. At this stage, you didn't think that the fire was really going to get to you.
We thought it had been contained away from us. And then the moment that Simon had got the news that it was, you know, had leapt Mount York Road and was coming up towards us, really then, and we said, well, we'll go back and do our final stuff on our houses. And really then, his house would have been under, you know, would have been under severe threat within moments. Mm. And it sort of unfolded from then.
At what point did you realise that things were far more serious than you previously thought?
Certainly the sort of level of smoke, the arrival of the fire, engines and so forth. But for me personally, going in and doing all that initial preparation, which includes bringing in, you know, your plastic garden hoses and getting them into the cement cool house, and conditions were so much better in the house than out. And then looking out the window and seeing that what I thought was like, you know, the equivalent of a spot fire outside the house, and then dragging the hose out and plugging it in and taking it up to that little spot fire, and then and just being absolutely overwhelmed by flame and smoke. I mean, there was just no way that the amount of water I could get out of my garden hose was going to do anything. And then coming back inside, seeking some refuge, and then, you know, I mean, Susan had been doing all other sorts of stuff as well. And then a professional firefighter, someone from the town brigade, came in and sort of began monitoring the situation in our house with us.
But there was a point, wasn't there, where you realised you had to get out.
Absolutely, because, yeah.
And what happened there?
Well, then we were, and remember we're mountains girls, so we've got all sorts of, you know, beliefs and so forth going in our head, and then one moment we were downstairs in the bathroom, downstairs bathroom, which was our refuge point, and we were just sitting there and say, well, okay, well, let's meditate. And that was beautiful because we were quite calm, but the door was still open, and so we saw a flame, we heard the cracking of the glass in the downstairs study, and then saw the flame coming in downstairs, which really was not meant to happen in our plan, in our imaginary, whatever. And the fireman, this fabulous fireman, John, who's up the stairs, I yelled that news out to him, and he was also monitoring what was happening outside. And then he said, get out, get out. And by that stage, we were absolutely certain we should get out too. So
Rolly, while this was going on, you were how far away?
We were probably 250, 300 metres away, further north, down at the end of the street.
And how was it unfolding for you?
Much, much differently to it did for Katrina. they copped the main front of the hot fire in quite a narrow band, and the flanks of the fire then sort of crept slowly, much more slowly, you know, sideways, and eventually engulfed us. But we had time to, you know, make more preparations. And later on, after dark, which is when the main fire reached us, we had time, with the help of the local town brigade, to backburn around the house. And it was a relatively, you know, ordered procedure, and it all went very well. But in the intervening time, I'd been up the street and seen what was going on up there.
What did you see?
Well, first time I went up the street, I saw Susan and Katrina's house burning from inside, which was pretty horrible to see, like looking through the windows and seeing nothing but flame.
This is a house that you've built.
Yeah. And, you know, three other houses across the road, but it turned out to be four other houses across the road burning, you know, a gas bottle going off, like a jet engine taking off. And pretty much a deserted street. Obviously, something had come. The fire had come through incredibly quickly, and the wise thing to do was just to buzz off.
How did you feel remaining there?
We felt quite safe.
Did you?
Just a few hundred metres away, it was a completely different story. And the randomness of what the fire takes and doesn't take is unbelievable. And there's a house next door to Susan and Katrina's house, which is lightweight timber, like Western Red Cedar weatherboards, with a cottage garden around it. And it's untouched. There was no one protecting that house, and it was missed by the fire. And there's another house next to that that was protected by nothing but a couple of strings of prayer flags, and it's standing. And yet a house like Susan and Katrina's, which was fairly well prepared and quite fireproof, went.
My guests this morning here on Life Matters are Rolly Clark, who's a builder and resident of St. George's Parade in Mount Victoria, and Katrina Schlunker, academic with UTS and a neighbour of Rolly's. Katrina, when did you return to the street and what did you see?
That was awful, because we stayed with a gorgeous friend, Sarah, in Medlow Bath that night, and in that intervening time, of course, you start hoping again, because although we'd not been allowed into the house, we'd gone back the night before to and had seen it, that it was something of a shell. But you, then your mind begins going, well, maybe, you know, like maybe some of the books downstairs, or maybe some of the, you know, some of the things, or some of the, you know, some, I don't know, CD's fantasy, I have to say now. But you think maybe just one of the rooms somehow
survived.
Yeah, so, nothing happened.
So when you turned up, what did you see?
It's just so extraordinary, like the blackened state of things. I mean, remember the bath, and we had a huge bath, was completely filled with water. How could that possibly have melted to nothingness? And fixtures, the downstairs refuge, you know, how does a shower melt? How do, you know, so nothing. I mean, but, so, you know, some of the cookware survived.
And this would be the bathroom is where you were planning to
downstairs. Yeah,
planning to
yeah, and that just has a little window access, and so that's how obviously how hot it was, and how accurate was that call to get out when we got out.
Rolly, you've lived there for a very long time. Have you seen anything like this before?
No, we've seen a few fires, but they've never been a direct hit on where we live. This is the first time that's happened, and. It was incredible. In any fire that strikes St George's Parade has to start on Mount York Road, because all the bad fires come from the west, driven by a westerly wind. So I guess that's made us relatively safe, whereas people down the mountains eventually get fire.
Now, the differences between these two houses, and you built both of these houses, is one, and this is the one that survived, was built to different standards.
They were about the same standards about the same time, and it's just that we didn't cop the main front of the fire.
So what are your thoughts on the, after hearing about these homes lost in the in the last week, and of course we've seen so many over the last couple of decades in Australia, there has been introduction of new standards for building standards in bushfire-prone areas. Mm-hmm. Is it something that you would embrace as a builder?
No, I don't embrace it, but I think it sort of, it's good that the general standards of fireproofness are ramped up. And if Katrina's house was built to the standards of today, the main difference would have been windows. They would have been more fireproof than hers, and there's a good chance that would have saved the house. But I guess I like people to have a fair bit of freedom as well. Mm. I don't swallow wholeheartedly that everyone has to be completely safe all the time. There's a certain degree of risk living in the bush, and a lot of the people that live in the Blue Mountains live there because they appreciate the bush. And I think people should be able to live quite simply, and quite often the fire regulations make it very difficult for that.
What about the cost? How much extra is it to build a home that fulfills those regulations compared to not?
Well, for a $500,000 house, which is quite a common price for a house these days, it adds, I think, somewhere between $50,000 and $70,000 to the cost.
Mm. Would you, if you were to build again, would you add that extra onto the house?
Well, I wouldn't have any choice.
Right.
Yeah. And that, in some ways, a good thing, I guess, and in other ways, it's a bad thing.
Yeah. Katrina, you headed back to the home, you stood there and you saw that it was entirely burnt out. What were the thoughts that went through your head looking at what had been your home for the last 20 years?
Well, I'm clearly not going to be able to have Robs and Rolls down to dinner anytime soon. I guess that unbelievability that ordinary things are simply not there. That just absolute ash, that fire really is that powerful. And I think that's the thought about no design on earth, I think, will actually, if you're in that path, will stop it. I mean, that, again, that doesn't mean you're not careful and you don't do the right things and so forth, but there's also just the power of that heat, and in an ever, you know, heating world, that's the sort of, like, it's really has to be a thing about thinking bigger. And I mean, the personal sadness, of course, is just every things that are lost, you know, and it's the things that are irreplaceable in people's hands, handwriting, or little kids who are now huge adults. But if we just keep thinking small, we get nowhere. I mean, here we are on a show called Life Matters. Well, it's got to be more than our life and our house that matters. You know, it's got to be a connective issue, a connective point to other people who have little. I mean, we've just... okay, we lost all that, but we have had hundreds of, you know, offers and things given to us. And that's the sort of thing that should be built upon, you know, like there is a connection with how, with trusting the Australian people to be lovely and, you know, you're not allowed to say bloody, are you? But both.
I think you can. It's all right. If you've just lost your home to bushfires, you're definitely allowed to say bloody.
But just both political parties, the whole system should think about that. Trust Australians more to be lovely because they're bloody amazing. And so why do we want to, you know, have, you know, be so frightened of not having a refugee on Australian soil? You know, what's going to happen? You know,
so, et cetera, et cetera. For you, what's ahead for the next 6 to 12 months? What do you have an idea of what it entails? Are you going to rebuild in the same spot?
See, that's a very big question, Robbie. And that's the question because, you know, like I love that street. I'm just so glad that, you know, even though I don't know whether Buster ever liked me, Susie, but I love Susie and Buster and the dogs that they're still there. I love Robs and Rolls down the road. We love, you know, Roberto across the street. We love that sort of street and what's happened, you know, that sort of life. And we also love living and being constantly reminded of the beauty of the trees and the reality of Australian bush aesthetic, and it's just beautiful. That's truth. We also scared of it or weary. Yeah, so I don't know. A cement box at the moment in Sydney is just bloody gorgeous too.
Yeah.
What about you, Rolly? Has it changed the way that you see your street after?
Not at all. No. Look, I like living in the bush. I'm quite happy to take that risk. We were lucky this time, and that's good. And it's quite a challenge, I think, to build or design and to build a house that is good to live in, you know, and with connection to nature and is also fireproof. I think people should build smaller. I think they should build in a more eco kind of way, whatever that word means, but we all have a bit of a feeling for what it means. And I think it's very disappointing that our Prime Minister is not wanting to see that this is related to a climate change problem.
Okay.
And I can see you don't want to talk about that.
Well, look, it's obviously a major issue.
But yeah, it's a very major issue, and I think it has to be addressed from the top.
Yeah.
There are people up in the mountains that are fighting very hard to sort of save the World Heritage value of the Blue Mountains that don't really get a look in on this sort of stage. Mm. And the National Parks people, the remote area firefighting team have done an incredible job in the last week. You don't hear about them. The RFS has also done an incredible job, but they're getting lots of publicity. Everyone has been fighting very hard for what they think is important. And, you know, for me, it is the World Heritage value of that place that makes it worthwhile.
Mm. Thank you ever so much for coming in and sharing your stories. And good luck, particularly you, Katrina. I know it's going to be a very tough few months for you and for so many people in the communities of the Blue Mountains as well. But we really appreciate you sharing your time. Thank you.
Great.
Rolly Clark, builder and resident of St. George's Parade in Mount Victoria, and Katrina Schlunker, academic with the University of Technology in Sydney, and Rolly's neighbour, who unfortunately lost her home on St. George's Parade in Mount Victoria as well. And, of course, our thoughts go out to everybody in those communities and elsewhere across New South Wales who have been affected by fire over this very traumatic week. Robbie Buck with you, filling in for Natasha Mitchell this morning here on Life Matters. And coming up next, we're going to have a look at a new centre that is designed for dementia.
100 million years ago, a bird landed in Victoria and left some tracks. Now, Tony Martin has examined them.
Well, it was amazing. Within the first 5 minutes of looking at these tracks, I realized at least one of them had to be from a bird. And that was the one that had a really long gouge mark from its rear toe from when it landed onto the sand flat 105 million years ago.
The oldest signs of a bird in Australia. It's an amazing story. In the Science Show this Saturday at 12...
What does the world look like if you suffer from dementia? A new centre in Victoria enables carers to see the world through the eyes of someone with dementia and shows how small design changes can make a big difference. It's a view of the world that, unfortunately, many more of us will see. In 10 years, an estimated 400,000 Australians will be diagnosed with dementia, with over 1 million people caring for them. The Dementia Learning Centre was officially opened yesterday, and I'm joined by Marie McCabe, the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia Victoria, and Scott Newman, a community aged care worker who specialises in recreation. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining us on Life Matters.
Thanks, Robbie.
Marie, the centrepiece of this new centre is a video screen, which sounds a bit unusual, but just take us there and give us an idea of what the aim is of this video screen, because it's not a standard video screen, is it?
No, and Robbie, it's actually the technology rather than the screen, and we really believe that this will be a game changer in the way that education is delivered. The thing about the screen, the wall itself is about 10 metres by 2 metres. It's the technology that's the really powerful part. And what it does, it actually shows you a home scenario. So you have a 3D experience. So yesterday what we did was we took people through a home, somebody's home, and we took it through looking at it from our eyes, and then from the eyes of somebody living with dementia. And it was such a powerful experience. And the standout for me was the bathroom. And, you know, we see in all, you know, modern design that things are monochromatic. So you walk into a bathroom and it's pristine with white walls, floors, and, you know, all white fittings. And walking into this bathroom yesterday through the eyes of somebody living with dementia, it was like walking into snow. Mm. And you couldn't distinguish anything. So you couldn't see the toilet against the wall or the floor, and there was a linen basket in there, and that was white, so you couldn't actually distinguish what that was.
So, Marie, just give us an idea of what the difference is between somebody with dementia and without dementia. When you say it looks like snow, what are the major differences between the two?
Well, many people living with dementia have perceptual disturbances, and what happens is that the brain can't make sense or interpret the environment accurately. And it really is this blurred experience where nothing is clear. And, you know, things move. So, you know, it's kind of like if there are patterns on things, they actually seem to be moving rather than still. So you and I would look at Venetian blinds, for example, and we can see that there are slats on the window. For some people living with dementia, those slats actually move. So it looks like they're moving towards them or away from them, or there's this wave effect going on. So it really is very confronting to see what actually occurs in the world of somebody living with dementia.
So this technology, it can show you what it's like in a bathroom, but it is also able to give you an idea of an experience of, say, walking through a shopping centre, for example, if you're suffering from dementia. What would be the experience like for a shopping centre?
Well, it would be all of this stimulus that is coming at the person where they can't make sense of what is actually occurring. And so things are amplified. So sounds are amplified. It may be that they have no idea where to go, that signs make no sense. And they many of them can't distinguish that and ask for help. So they can't say, excuse me, I'm lost. They're just lost. And, you know, so they'll respond to the environment in certain ways. And, you know, so they may respond scared, and then if they're approached by somebody, they'll be fearful, and they may, you know, they might back away, or they might start to, you know, they might cry. They may, you know, they're just afraid. Mm. It's an experience that they just can't make sense of the world.
So these are very public spaces that we're talking about at the moment. But of course, I take it that this technology is able to teach people how to perhaps transform their own homes to make them more comfortable for people suffering with dementia. What are some of the main areas or elements that can be changed to make it a warmer experience?
Well, they're very simple things, and it can be like making sure that the floor coverings are a very different colour from the wall, and that seating is a very different colour from the floor covering in the wall. So it's much more easily distinguished by the person. The use of bright colours is facilitative for people, and ensuring that lighting doesn't cast shadows, because in the shadows, pardon me, people can have the experience of illusions and misperceptions, so that lighting is clear and bright and that it doesn't reflect. So shiny floor surfaces can occur like being wet, and then the person will be afraid, they'll be anxious about standing on it for fear of slipping. you know, that things like glass-fronted cupboards so that you can see in the cupboards. If you've got a family member coming over, they can see if there's food in the cupboard, if, you know, there's no food in the cupboard and what they need to do to, you know, to support the person better in the environment.
Mm. Scott, you work in this area on a day-to-day basis. What do you see the value of a centre like this? How can it change the way that carers interact with people suffering from dementia?
I think the biggest thing is creating an empathy within care-based workers or even primary carers for people living with dementia. I think if we can show people what it's like to be, you know, in that role, I guess, of the person with dementia, then, you know, maybe they will respond in a different way when they may see a behaviour and maybe align it with, you know, some of those things that Marie talks about that you may interact on a day-to-day basis with.
I take it can come down to some very simple elements too. I mean, we talked about changing the colours in the rooms and making it simpler. But things like notes next to light switches, for example, can be really effective, can't they?
Yeah, exactly. You know, those abilities still remain for quite some time. So, you know, making sure that people can actually help themselves first before they try and, you know, tackle these solutions, I guess, or these problems, then, you know, that is the key.
Mm. Have you had much experience in changing the colours in a home? And if so, what were your findings with it?
I guess going back to your comment there with regard to notes above lights, which is, you know, whether it be television remotes, etc., we've found that, you know, using colours in those environments can be really effective and has actually helped that person to maintain those functions.
Can some of these simple changes, are they able to keep a person in their own home much longer? Do we see a solid outcome from some of these changes?
Absolutely. I mean, my primary work is in the community with people living in their own homes and these changes and I guess the Dementia Learning Centre are tools that are only going to help us keep people in their homes for longer periods of time.
Mm. Marie, just going back to the, you mentioned patterns before and the fact that, that some patterns can have a bad effect for people suffering from dementia. How does that work? I mean, I've heard stories that even the uniforms that some carers might be wearing, for example, could be detrimental to their experience.
Absolutely. And yesterday what we showcased was actually walking through down the passageway of the home and they had striped wallpaper on the wall. And what occurred through the eyes of somebody with dementia was this billowing effect. And it was really, it was very confronting. It was very in your face. And it was, you know, you immediately didn't want to go down there. And, you know, so if that were just replaced by a coat of paint, which is, you know, what we want to inspire people is to have their organisations adopt dementia-friendly principles, which are in fact friendly for everybody. So things like signage, you don't just have the sign, but a picture of what's there. So, you know, you don't just say toilet, it's a picture of a toilet. And that's friendly for people who don't have English as a first language. It's friendly for people who have visual impairment. So it really is about creating an environment that clearly distinguishes what you want to highlight in the environment.
I take it, though, Marie, the aim for this centre is to try and expand it out of just people's homes or designated centres of care into more public everyday situations. I mean, where would you like to see the impact of something like this?
Oh, look, we want to inspire all organisations to adopt dementia-friendly principles. And, you know, the thing, Robbie, is in our community, we do quite well in terms of supporting people with physical disabilities, but we are a long way behind in terms of supporting people with cognitive disabilities, you know, like dementia.
My guest this morning is Marie McCabe. She's the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia Victoria, and Scott Newman, a community aged care worker who specialises in recreation. Marie, there's also some talk of special robots. This sounds very futuristic, but I take it this is actually on the cards.
Absolutely, and we're actually working with Professor Rajiv Khosla from La Trobe University, and we've got some of these social robots out at the moment being trialled with some of our clients. So they're in the homes of people living with dementia and their families and carers, and the robots, they're extraordinary. They can actually be programmed to remind the person to take their medication, to play their favourite music, to remind them to call their loved one, and they're also, they're a mobile phone, a built-in phone. They can also be, reminded when there are times of the day when people can get agitated, and they can be programmed to kind of play soothing music at that time of the day. And one of the most challenging things for carers is the repetitive behaviour and questioning that sometimes occurs with people living with dementia, where they might ask, 30 times, what am I doing today? What am I doing today? Now, for the carer, that can be really distressing. The robot doesn't mind. It's like using a NavMan where it will just repeat very calmly back to you the answer. And it's, we know that in environments of high levels of expressed emotions, people with dementia don't do as well and they have higher levels of anxiety. So, it is such a relief for carers, and the feedback from carers and people living with dementia is they just love it. It's been such a support.
Scott, how do you feel about possibly being replaced by a robot, at least on the odd day?
I think it's great technology, but I guess protecting my own job, funnily enough, I guess you can't replace the 90% of body language and that form of communication as well.
Yeah.
And look, I just want to say, Robbie, the intention is not to replace people.
No,
it really
sure
is, as an adjunct to care. And you can never replace human touch and human compassion.
No, we can wrap Scott in a bit of alfoil every now and then if the robots need it.
I think your job's safe, Scott.
Marie, just before we go, give us an idea when you walk into the centre, because we've only really mentioned it as a video screen, but it's a lot more than that, isn't it? It's actually a sort of all-encompassing donut-sized room that is immersive. Just give us a sense, when you walk in, what do you actually see and feel?
Well, when you walk into the building, you'd look at the building, you'd think it's a nice building, and then when you distinguish the dementia-friendly principles, it becomes very obvious. When you walk into the Dementia Learning Centre, it's a room, it's about, 15 metres by 3 or 4 metres, and it's just, it's got these donut-shaped lights, and we can change the colour of the lights, so there's a whole range of colours that we can actually change to create the environment that we want. And we could create a rainforest in there and do a relaxation session with carers or people living with dementia. And, the technology is very inconspicuous, and it's really the room. It's just, looks like a normal room with the big lights. So it's what the technology does that makes it so special and will really create a powerful experience for people who are using it and for people living with dementia, because we can see immediately where people are engaged and where they're not and manipulate the screen and the technology and the items on the screen to create other environments. So we're looking forward to some of the exciting research that we can do.
Marie, we don't know how to cure dementia, of course, but there are improvements in how to deal with the disease, and we're learning more about those. What are some of the, the major initiatives that help people stay independent longer in terms of, health and diet, behaviour, those sorts of things?
Yeah, look, exercise is really important, and there's been studies released recently that show that exercise increases the volume of the hippocampus. Now, the hippocampus is the area of the brain where Alzheimer's disease originates, and the greater volume, then the more time it's going to take for people to be symptomatic. So even in the early stages of dementia, it's really important that people exercise, that they remain socially engaged and connected, and that they have a really, they have a good diet and do the things that they love. And it's important that our communities are supportive of this because, one of the things that our clients tell us repeatedly is it's the experience of profound isolation that they have when getting a diagnosis of dementia that really, has a significant impact on the quality of their life. Mm. So it's that social engagement, it's that doing things you love, it's, you know, making things at home as dementia-friendly as possible to support people in their environment. And those things make a very big difference for people living with dementia, their families and their carers.
And who knows, hopefully a crossword is thrown in there at some stage as well.
Absolutely. Look, all of the things that keep our brain active, keeping our brain active is as important as keeping our body active.
Thank you to the both of you so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning. Appreciate your time.
Pleasure. Thanks so much, Robbie. Bye, Scott.
Marie McCabe, CEO of Alzheimer's Australia Victoria, and Scott Newman, a community aged care worker who specialises in recreation, and just having a chat about this new dementia learning centre in Victoria that aims to help people understand how people suffering from dementia see the world and how to make it easier for them to live. Robbie Buck with you. This is the filling in for Natasha Mitchell on Life Matters this morning. Speaking of crosswords, don't go anywhere. We've got a birthday celebration up. The crossword has just turned 100, and up next, somebody who is, well, celebrating.
You're listening to RN. As bushfire emergencies continue, tune to our sister network, ABC Local Radio, for up-to-the-minute information and advice. Your local ABC station is an emergency services broadcaster with warnings and regular updates from official local sources. You can also visit abc.net.au/emergency, now easy to use on your mobile as well as PC. Have your bushfire survival plan ready and follow the advice issued by your local emergency services.
And now you and I are invited to a birthday party. Although you can forget the birthday hat, you'll need a thinking cap instead. The reason? We're celebrating the 100th birthday of the crossword puzzle. David Astle, or DA, as you may know him, is the creator of crosswords that will make your hair curl. That is, if you haven't already pulled it out. David has written Clutopia, the story of 100 years of the crossword, to mark this special occasion. And he's uncovered some pretty extraordinary facts in the process. Did you know, for example, that a crossword could be used to solve a murder? Or that you could propose to your loved one by hiding a message in the clues? It's all true. To take us from one across to 100 down, David Astle joins me now. Good morning, David.
Morning, Robbie.
I'm slightly nervous, of course. Last time you were on this program, almost a year ago, I think that you presented Natasha with an anagram that was a little bit dark.
It was dark. In fact, she does have a sinister trick about her name, because you think about the first five letters of Natasha when reversed. Creates Satan, and Mitchell obviously ends in hell.
Yes.
And you're not much better, I'm going to have to say, Robbie.
No. When I was sitting down last night in preparation for this interview, thinking, I wonder what he'll get out of this, and all, I think I got Bruce Bobsky, but...
Yeah, that's right. Now, the Bs do actually are a bit of a roadblock, but when you think about, just in the same way that Natasha has that, the bookend trick, you're the same, because Rob obviously means to steal, and Buck is money, so right away there's designs of larceny. And you're also a gun toter with a BB in your name as well. So, but I'm more worried about Life Matters, which to me suggests fatter slime. I don't know what's going on there. What's happening at that show?
It's very hard to say. I'm just filling in, honestly. Look, it's such a fascinating book, this, because obviously it's for word lovers. It takes you through, the whole background behind the crossword. But let's go. I mentioned the murder and mm-hmm. how a crossword was used to solve a murder. Let's go straight to the heart of that, because that's an extraordinary story.
It was. I felt a bit of a heel celebrating when I learnt of this story, because it was ultimately about the death of a young East German boy called Lars. And it happened in 1981 in a city called Halle Neustadt. And they found the young boy's body inside a suitcase beside a railway track on... between Neustadt and Leipzig. And they had, while they knew who the boy was, they had no idea of the perpetrator. And the only clues they had to go on were the suitcase itself in which he was found, and balls of newspaper that were clumped around just to insulate the bag further. And on one of those scrunched up pieces of broadsheet, thankfully, was a semi-solved crossword. And it was the handwriting, ultimately, that led to the big reveal.
Mm.
And even more creepily, And this is a well-known story within East Germany, but obviously not so well-known beyond the borders. So it was my grim privilege to investigate this story through all the case files and using translators. I discovered that the key phrase, the key clue, in fact, that lifted the lid on the perpetrator was Geschriebenes, which is, I understand, means handwriting. So it was almost a... it was the ultimate puzzle, and thankfully it was solved.
That's one of the more sinister stories in your book. But one of the brighter stories, of course, is the compiler who used his crossword for a very romantic aim. Take us through this story. It's great.
It is a lovely story, and we're talking here about Lindsay Brown, who a lot of listeners would be familiar with that name, and LB, as he was fondly known. And in fact, he was my mentor for many years, being the sort of giant that he was in the Fairfax papers. And I pestered him continually until he gave me some tuition and then gave me a break. So it was my pleasure to go back through Lindsay's life. We lost Lindsay about 10 years ago, but his second wife is still with us, Elspeth. And I spent a lot of hours just sitting with Elspeth in her Sydney kitchen, going through these old papers and old memories and old crosswords. And when he proposed to his first wife, it was through the guise of a crossword. And it was Nancy Moore that he was serenading. He used clues as an acrostic. And so if you read down, it said, Nancy Moore, will you marry me? And then when the Herald found out that he'd been doing this, he was admonished. But that didn't stop him, because he just used another technique to celebrate the fact that she said yes. Even more beautifully, though, Nancy, after they had several children and a wonderful life together, it was prematurely cut short because of Nancy's illness. She had a brain tumour. And Lindsay just made more and more crosswords trying to generate money, and also was a champion on Pick a Box with Bob Dyer.
Oh.
And he accrued all this jackpot money and crossword money to try and find cures all around the world. Ultimately, that search was in vain. However, it was proving a recidivist to the last. Lindsay then had his heart stolen some years later in 1964 by Elspeth herself, and he pursued her in the same cruciverbal fashion, saying, essentially sort of sending her all these covert serenades through the puzzles.
So come clean, David. Have you ever used the nation's crosswords for your own romantic pursuits?
Look, you know, actually, I do owe the crossword for being the catalyst of my marriage, which is a really strange thing to acknowledge. But when I first worked at a publishing house, my future wife and I did not get on. I'm a chatterbox, Robbie, in case you haven't figured it out already.
I might have guessed.
And my better half is, she was in charge of the deadline of each book. And so consequently, when I was just gadabouting in the office or flirting with the barista downstairs, she was not so well pleased. And she didn't realise that I was the same boy who also made the crosswords that she loved. And it was only on seeing a crossword sitting on my kitchen table when she came around for a coffee that she put the two people together, and she realised that this wonderful crossword maker was also this annoying pest in the office.
And you bet somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, that's right. Thankfully, she erred on the side of I'll give him a chance.
So let's look at the history. 100 years this year, 1913, which is effectively the start of the crossword as we know it, although there were word puzzles before that. Take us back to that beginning. How did it start?
Look, it probably will surprise a lot of people to learn that it's only 100 years old. It would seem as though crosswords have been part of our lives forever. But it was in 1913 where an expat Liverpudlian called Arthur Wynne was confronted with a scary gap on his page as a sub-editor for the New York World. And this was December 21, so it's only so many more sleeps until the big day. But he was just had nothing to fill this hole. And he just basically said, well, I need to create something. So it was almost at knife point that he put together what he called a word cross. And the big breakthrough that Arthur almost accidentally came upon was that, unlike other word grids that pre-existed this moment, Arthur had added two things that seem so obvious now and yet were sort of quite ingenious at the time. He added internal blocking, so he created that idea of patterns within squares, and he also created a sort of crude version of internal numbering. And those two just small tweaks to the prototype created this massive genre.
And it spread reasonably quickly, didn't it? I mean, through fits and starts, but it got to an international level really just in a few decades.
And I think the secret to that, you're right, this was 1913, obviously, and then World War One suddenly landed upon us. And so crosswords were in a holding pattern for a couple of years. But then in 1922, so less than 10 years later, the Brits cautiously adopted this new thing that Americans had created with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder too, I'm going to have to say, because they thought, how dare the Americans come up with this new way of playing with the language that we had created. So just if I could personify John Bull for a moment. But what the Brits did was they sort of evolved the clues, the straight dictionary clues that the Americans had created, and introduced all that wordplay tradition that Lewis Carroll and acrostics and all their wonderful wordplay literature had suckled them on. They introduced that so
are they to blame for the cryptic? Is that what you're saying here, David?
They're to credit for my career, Robbie. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. But it's also why the crossword did really blossom, because it was as though the Americans and the British both thought as though they had invented this genre. And so there was no parochialism left. It just had to proliferate, which it did.
David Astell is my guest this morning. He is possibly well known to you if you're a crossword aficionado, then he certainly would be as DA, somebody who is equally loved and feared. And his new book, which is called Clutopia, looking back over the century that the crossword has been enjoyed and frustrated. How does it translate into other languages? The English language was where it began, but it also moved into, well, Russian very quickly, and even into Arabic languages. Does it transpose very easily?
I was, I'm going to be honest here, I was gobsmacked when the further I dug to write this book on this kind of open-ended safari, trying to find crosswords across the century, across the world. I had presumed that there must be a lot of languages where the crossword had not made its mark because of those difficulties that you just foreshadowed. In fact, I was wrong. I couldn't. There was not one language, main language, that I could find where there was not a crossword in existence, and that includes the likes of Arabic, which comes up with an elegant solution by having some of the answers reading left to right as well as right to left, so that it allows for more of their beautiful sort of cursive script to be incorporated in a matrix. Mm. And even Chinese and Japanese, with their most eloquent ideograms, they found a way in a sort of mahjong-like solution to cross over notions instead of characters.
David, you've been compiling crosswords since you were 13. You do it on a daily basis. How does the world look to you, a person of that persuasion? Are you just constantly looking around you and absorbing words and mentally taking them apart and putting them back together again?
I am constantly. Look, it's a bit of an affliction. I think if I could paraphrase Shakespeare, I think some are born to nerdery and some achieve it and some have it thrust upon them. And I have always had this bent to muck around with words and letters. I grew up in Balgala in Sydney, and I noticed that owl nests in the middle of that because that was the same bird that I met in Winnie the Pooh, and that's the same bird that was sitting inside my suburb. And poor mum, she must have thought, you know, at the royal age of four as I was, that she may need a specialist or some form of distraction. And in the end, it was mum who introduced me to crosswords, and I think possibly just to give me an outlet to pour all this kind of crazy word noise that was just bubbling away in my head.
That said, is it a certain kind of mind that is better suited, particularly to the cryptic crosswords, because they're a different kind of language and they require a different approach than standard quick crossword. Is there a certain kind of mind which is far more suited, or can anybody give it a go?
I'm in the second camp. I think anyone can give it a go. In fact, your previous guest talking about Alzheimer's, that's, there are real benefits in giving it a go, in trying to understand the all the trickery that's at play. Because ultimately, these tricks are just a set of rules, and these rules, just like in a game of chess, need to be observed to operate. However, you know, like there's an anagram, and that needs to have a signpost, and that needs to have, the slime, the fatter slime needs to be there to be mixed up into life matters. There are homophones, and there's reversal. However, where I will deviate from my stand is that while I think anyone, and that is anyone, is capable of understanding a cryptic in the same way as they're understanding a game of chess, it's just that next step of finding the love in it. And there's so much love and levity and eureka just waiting. But if you're not getting the joy out of hearing all these sharp riddles that each clue is, then that's not a joy that I can implant. It's a joy that is waiting to be discovered, and hopefully it's within you.
Yeah, and indeed, the devotees who are really attached to it, there's nothing that would pull them away from it. Those two letters, D and A, when they're next to a crossword, for a lot of people, it does fill them with a sense of dread. You have a reputation, David, and you seem like such a personable and lovely man.
I am, Robert.
I know you are, I can tell. But you have this reputation for causing such pain on people. Is it true? Is there a certain perverse satisfaction about it?
Apparently the Marquis de Sade was a most personable man as well.
Is that right? I didn't realise that. Did he do crosswords? Probably.
Yeah, he was. That's right. He should have actually been the inventor. But there's a perception that I'm meant to be some kind of recluse or an evil man with sharpening cleavers in a back room. I just like tricky crosswords. I like making crossword clues evasive and not. I don't break easily. I'm not a pinata that sort of busts open on the first swing. But that's important. That also within the crossword hierarchy, that there are kinder crossword makers, just so people can start and get their gumption. Mm-hmm. But then you need to have. Just as most, The Guardian and New York Times recognise, you need to have the more ornery and al dente chefs also on your books.
So for you, who is the crossword compiler that you could never have enough of, and why?
That's a great question. And in fact, I'm going to have to single out, he is a Guardian compiler amongst other newspapers that he serves. His name is John Halpern, H-A-L-P-E-R-N, and he calls himself Paul after his dead brother, in fact, in The Guardian. And he's also known as Mudd, M-U-D-D, because that was his name, according to an ex-girlfriend, for the Financial Times. And he's Punk in The Independent.
And this is all the same person?
It's all the same person. He is one of the few professional crossword makers in the UK, and I'm grateful that he is, because he does make terrific crosswords. Even just one I solved on the bus to come here, the clue was Fool Oscar, but not Wild. And I thought, well, that's such an elegant clue. I had no idea what the answer was, and I kept on chewing and found out that it was Halfwit, because Fool is a Halfwit, and Oscar is only one half of the wit that Oscar Wilde is. And it's just, it's an amazing clue, because it's so different. And that's what he does. He just, while those rules that I mentioned, he tests those rules and bends and experiments. And I like to think I do the same.
So what are those characteristics that really shine through for connoisseurs of the crossword, those elements that people really savour in a great one?
Okay, I think it's a clue that reads like a story, where there's no crack in the pretense in the subterfuge. So it's a clue like potty train, and you think, wow, that just makes me think of a young baby on a change table and talcum powder at the ready. When in fact, it's a double meaning clue that's saying the answer is loco. Because loco is both a word for potty, that is someone who is unsound, and train, of course, is a loco. Mm. And that's that beautiful, seamless dovetailing of wordplay and definition that the best clues do. And the best compilers experiment in areas with joy and with chicanery that have not been tested before.
Well, David, it's a small insight into what is a terrific book, even if you don't do cryptic crosswords, which I am ashamed to say I don't. But you get a sense all the way through the book as you're writing this that you're just enjoying leaving little tidbits of information and allowing the reader to come to terms with the clues as they read through it. Thanks ever so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning, or as some people might call it,
fatter slime.
Fatter slime, yes. We'll get the new IDs made in the next 24
hours. That's right,
if
you could, that would be wonderful.
Thanks ever so much, David. Been a real treat. David Astle, the crossword compiler that many people fear but also love, and also the author of his latest book, Cluetopia, the story of 100 years of the crossword, and a terrific read it is too. Just about time to say farewell for Life Matters this morning. No cross with Michael Cathcart, but do stay tuned. Coming up next on Books and Arts Day, he'll be presenting a forum from the Melbourne Festival with Natalia Kaliada, one of the founders of the Belarus Free Theatre. Tomorrow, talk back to Love or Loathe Thy Neighbour, after the discussion that we had this morning with our guests from Mount Victoria. A great time to talk about what a neighbour is, how well you know your neighbour, and how you deal with your neighbours as well. And that's tomorrow morning on Talk Back. Thanks for your company. It's been lovely sitting in the chair. I'll join you again same time tomorrow. Until then, bye for now.